Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray, and I'm actually quite sick this week. So if I'm not my usual effervescent self, then we can all chalk that up to some dodgy food that I ate a couple of days back. And believe me, I'm doing you a favor when I say I'm gonna spare you the details. But in this week's show, we are joined by Wired journalist Andy Greenberg to chat about one of his areas of interest and coverage, which is underground markets and cryptocurrencies. We also chat to Andy about his views on post-WikiLeaks leaking. Why did Edward Snowden go to Glenn Greenwald instead of WikiLeaks? And what does this tell us about WikiLeaks' founding philosophy? Stay tuned to hear all about that. In this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Julian Fay, CTO of Senatas. Senatas is a publicly listed Australian company that makes awesome, awesome layer 2 encryption technology. Check them out at senatas.com. And Julian joins us in this week's show to talk about the demise of TrueCrypt and to discuss various models for ensuring quality in encryption standards and code. That is at the end of this week's show. I hope you will enjoy it. But before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, it is time to run for the hills because there's another bug in OpenSSL, and much to my disappointment, there doesn't seem to be a logo this time.
No, it hasn't quite got the polish of the last Heartbleed bug, but yeah, here we are again. Obviously, there's been a lot of eyes on OpenSSL and GNU TLS and some of the other implementations of TLS since we saw Heartbleed come through, and there are a number of bugs. And the one that's really getting a bunch of attention is one that they're calling the change cipher spec bug that allows an active man in the middle to essentially downgrade you to no crypto. which, you know, given that confidentiality is one of the things that we rely on TLS for, is really not fantastic.
No, it's not, but at least it's not, hey, can I please have the contents of your memory? Yeah, okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Okay, obviously, contents of comms is less of a problem than stealing keys and stealing all of the comms.
I just want to go back on what I said, because I realize that it's 2014, and we're just describing a bug that lets you man in the middle an SSL connection, and I'm like, well, it's not that bad.
That's no big deal. We already have one. It's very nice. But yeah, there's a number of SSL bugs that are being talked up at the moment. I mean, there's one that looks plausibly like may even be some options for CodeExec, but that's a DTLS, which is the UDP implementation of TLS, rather than the mainstream one that the change cipher spec bug applies to. One of the mitigating factors here is that it's a bug that is between a vulnerable OpenSSL client and a vulnerable OpenSSL server, and the range of clients is basically all OpenSSL ever, and the range of servers is a bit more restricted. So it's, you know, it's only content decrypt, you know, for active man in the middle and OpenSSL in most cases, as opposed to all of them, which, yeah, as you say, that's good, right? By the standards of 2014 OpenSSL.
Just going to nip off out the back and shoot myself. Yeah, I caught some rumors about the man in the middle one, sort of swirling around, like just sort of, you know, within like 12 hours of the announcement. So I knew something was coming, but you know, it's just, it is kind of sad that these sort of things don't surprise us anymore. Now, Adam, it's a little bit confusing this week because, you know, you were just mentioning possible CodeExec bugs in OpenSSL, but it's not just OpenSSL. Quite happily, GNU TLS has patched a critical remote code execution bug.
Yeah, no, this one is nasty. This is a memory corruption potentially in the code execution in GNU TLS, and it's very, very early in the SSL handshake process. You know, some of the other ones we've seen have been more difficult to exploit. The, you know, OpenSSL one we were talking about was in the, you know, the UDP implementation. But this is like straight up mainline TCP SSL in GNU TLS in the server hello packet. You send like a long ID or
Insta
something.
Insta own. Like, yeah, what? Nice. Yeah,
so, sorry, long session ID. You know, what can you hear, is it? But anyway, fortunately, well, I guess everyone who's using GNU TLS has had a bad time of it over the years anyway, because GNU TLS has had a fairly rubbish history, both from a usability and a security point of view, but oh dear.
Now, look, speaking of SSL bugs and Heartbleed, indeed, you know, at the time that it was made public, you know, we said, look, you know, most of your major websites and stuff are going to patch against this. It's going to be all those little weird edge cases that are going to present problems. And we're seeing some news from ThreatPost here that a bunch of enterprise, like wireless kit, is still vulnerable to Heartbleed exploitation. That is not good.
Yeah, so a Portuguese researcher has put together a set of patches to the open source wireless access point software and open source wireless network client drivers to try and trigger Heartbleed bugs against EIP-TLS, so and EIP-TLS variants that use SSL crypto inside the wireless authentication mechanism EIP, or the EIP mechanism used inside wireless authentication, and has successfully triggered Heartbleed-style memory leaks from both clients and wireless access points using this this set of code, which is an interesting scenario, and certainly one, you know, it's in line with what we discussed about the, you know, the fact that this is embedded in all sorts of places, and we will see this turn up in funny places. And the question is whether or not we can turn this into, you know, actually stealing, you know, key material, for example, out of a client to then authenticate to a corporate wireless network. That would be a cool attack end to end, and we haven't seen that yet. But memory leak out of a, you know, your wireless wireless controller, your corporate wireless network, that's bad, especially when you're sharing the same wireless hardware infrastructure across your public guest network and your, you know, internal corporate, you know, LAN access network. And someone has, you know, can leverage any sort of access into that, you know, onwards into the rest of the corporate network. Like that's just a nightmare scenario for a lot of organizations.
So would you recommend that, you know, enterprises out there actually engage some consultants to come in and check their enterprise kit to make sure that this isn't happening? Because, yeah, that scenario you describe, it's not real pretty.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've reviewed a lot of wireless networks over the years for exactly this kind of thing. I mean, obviously, not specifically Heartbeat, but, you know, any issue with that wireless, those wireless controllers does result in fairly bad things. And I, you know, I think that is an important thing to for corporates to understand about their wireless infrastructure. You know, the fact that it is a very thin, you know, single vendor, you know, remote access solution. And that's, you know, from an architectural point of view, is something that you should be concerned about.
Now, with some good crypto news, Google is actually releasing an end-to-end encryption extension for Gmail, which is kind of a good idea, but still kind of ignores the fact that if someone drops a national security letter on you, on them, you know, targeting you, they're probably just going to undermine that plugin for you anyway. So I guess it depends on, you know, which problem you're trying to solve here, but it, I don't know, it can't be a step backwards, right?
No, I think this is a good thing. I mean, they're proposing, or they have got a beta of a client-side Chrome plugin that implements essentially GNU-PG or, you know, PGP mail crypto for Gmail. So end-to-end crypto with, you know, the reliability and interoperability that you would expect talking to PGP, you know, with other people. And that's really good. You know, the fact that they're pushing out a solution that prevents them from reading your email and, you know, mining it and selling the advertising around it. I mean, that for them, well, I guess they're assuming it's not going to have massive uptake, so it's not a big deal. It's good for the privacy nuts to have, you know, something to keep them, you know, to keep them occupied while they mine everyone else's mail.
That's right.
The question of whether, you know, like given a national security letter, whether, you know, what they do in the Lavabit scenario, you know, where the only option is to turn up and demand that they backdoor their crypto product to get the key material out, you know, a la Lavabit, that's going to be an interesting scenario, because this, you know, puts them very much in that scenario, because of course the reason they're proposing this as a Chrome plugin rather than just using JavaScript, you know, served by Gmail, I think, is to you know, try and provide some assurance that it's less likely to be tampered with in transit, that you can trust the JavaScript. They don't have the mega problem, you know, where you have JavaScript.
I didn't realize that it was a Chrome plugin. I mean, that makes more sense in that scenario. It makes me feel a bit more comfortable that it would be, you know, at least quite difficult for them to sort of subvert the crypto that they're offering you.
And I assume that's part of that design choice. I mean, I haven't read something that explicitly says that. And of course, Chrome auto updates, so they still have presumably the technical capability to do it, but maybe not instantly. And, you know, maybe it gives them some outs that, you know, the mega case where you've got JavaScript that validates your JavaScript that validates the JavaScript that actually does the crypto, you know, that really you can get around that in a relatively short period of time if you have the cooperation of the hosting provider. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's exactly what the problem that they're trying to solve, but I assume that's what the
is. I think that's a pretty safe assumption. Also, funnily enough, they've put a bit of a FU to the NSA into the code.
You may recall, listeners may recall the diagram, which famously had a little smiley face where you know, Google's network adds and removes SSL. It, of course, makes reference to that in one of the configuration setup scripts for building this plugin, which is quite funny and, as you say, a bit of
It is now, you know, the TrueCrypt disaster is sort of continuing to roll on. There's a bunch of guys in Switzerland who forked it. You know, the TrueCrypt audit guys are just like, we're going to keep auditing this, even though it's basically been end of life by someone. So it's all just, you know, I don't think anyone really knows what to do. The most important thing they seem to be thinking is they need to do something. Whether it's the right thing, whether it's the wrong thing, doesn't matter. Let's just do something.
Well, yeah, you get a bit of that sense, don't you? And I suppose on one hand, like continuing the TrueCrypt audit is good. I mean, like they collected, you know, crowdfunded money to do that. And so, you know, it's kind of the honorable thing to do to keep on doing it. And maybe they uncover, you know, the horrible bug that has caused this all to happen. Like maybe there really is an implementation flaw in that, you know, that we're going to find, and we might get some, you know, some closure or something. But yeah, I think you're right. Like, no one really is very sure what to do about this. It's a bit,
you know, you're taking security, I'm sorry to say, but you know, you're taking InfoSec a little bit too seriously when you use the word closure in reference to TrueCrypt, Adam.
Look, my neck beard is in full f-ing bloom at the moment. I have like that. It's an excellent and wonderful thing. And
so I mean, have you spent the week on the couch with a tub of ice cream? Is that what's going on? Or? It left us. Now, in news that came as a surprise to precisely no one, it turns out the NSA has a fair bit of facial recognition technology. But it's an interesting piece on the New York Times website because I actually wasn't as alarmed as I expected to be when I clicked on this headline, which is NSA collecting millions of faces from web images. Because, you know, it turns out, like, they asked an NSA spokesperson, you know, do you have access to the state driver's license databases? And they said no. And they said, do you have access to, you know, the photos of people that are taken at borders when people are on their way into the United States? And they said no comment. So it seems that, like, the focus of this seems to be on, you know, keeping a nice database of known bad faces and then maybe matching them to people coming in and out of the country, which you kind of think, well, it's kind of what the NSA is supposed to be doing, isn't it?
Well, exactly. What else did you think all of those border checks were for, right? I mean, the passport has a photo for a reason. So, yeah, I think you're quite right that no one is going to be super surprised. I mean, the fact that they would take, you know, that database, take that data and correlate it against, you know, images you scrape off your, you know, full take internet intercept, you know, that is, I guess, a little more creepy. I mean, you know, we saw, you know, GCHQ snooping on people's, you know, Yahoo cam internet sex sessions or whatever. And
genitalia recognition technology patented by GCHQ. Junk recognition.
I mean, you know, doing that is, I guess, a little more weird. And one of the other bits I thought was quite interesting in this article was that they said apparently they have tech to take to match satellite photos of terrain with background features from ground level photos, so they can say, here is, you know, three dudes standing around, and the example they gave was you know, near some trees by a dock, and they managed to match that up to, here is a dock, you know, on a river somewhere in Pakistan, near a, you know, terrorist training camp, because obviously terrorists. And I thought that was really interesting tech. I mean, you know, face recognition, I think we're all expecting because of science fiction, but you know, figuring out, you know, geolocating photos based on terrain, that's cool tech.
I think with a lot of these things, you know, there's nothing necessarily invalid about the method itself. It's just the constraints on the method and whether or not existing sort of legislation and interpretations of existing laws can sort of keep up and make sure it doesn't get creepy, you know. But, you know, this story makes me think, gee, I hope there's decent oversight on it, but it looks like it's... It might be being used for actual useful stuff. So there you go. Now, Iran was running a pretty sophisticated, you know, sort of spear phishing campaign. What makes this one cool, though, is they set up a fake news organization, had fake, you know, fake posts where they'd basically just plagiarize news from different sources, you know, give them bylines. They had multiple fake identities posing as journalists because, you know, journalists get reasonable access to people. They'd identify high value targets, spearfish them, get a whole bunch of their sort of logins to various things, and then, use those creds for various nefarious purposes. But it just looks like a pretty slick operation. It's kind of cool. There was a iSight Partners have put together a bit of a package on this.
Yeah, that's they've got a pretty good write-up of it and some you know, good examples of the sorts of techniques that they're using and the way that they're, you know, creating the fake identities and maintaining, you know, posting pictures of people's cats on their Twitter account to try and make them seem, you know, more like well-rounded people rather than, you know, clearly just, you know, fake accounts. But yeah, it's quite a sophisticated operation, and I guess you would expect that from a state organization. Obviously not sufficiently sophisticated that we're not talking about it on the news. There's no real discussion of what they were using it for. I mean, you can draw some conclusions, I guess, based on what Iran's interests are, but it's more about the techniques they were using to, AstroTurf and to build the fake personas and things, which, is interesting stuff, on both the attack and defense side.
So, yeah, you can go check that out in this week's show notes. The Wired piece links right through to the iSight Partners report. Now, those bugs in IPMI that popped up last year, I think it was Dan Farmer and HD Moore, had a look at them. As it turns out, they're not going away. They're going to have a very long shelf life, according to this latest report.
Yeah, so there has been a long history of bugs in lights out management systems, IPMI. There's various names from the different vendors for it. And Dan Farmer and HD Moore have been working on that. I think Dan Farmer got a cyber fast track grant from DARPA to look at implementation flaws in people's IPMI engines. Because this stuff is so is embedded and widely deployed in people's actual tin, it is quite difficult to upgrade and fiddly to do. And we are going to continue to see bugs. And I was quite surprised. I've done some work and broken into some lights out management systems in my time, as you might expect. And I was surprised at quite how bad it is in terms of the numbers that Dan Farmer is reporting. He said something like 90%. 90.1% of systems that they reviewed that used the older version of the IPMI standard had essentially no authentication. There's an option where you can just ask the remote end to, let's just not use authentication when we're talking, and it says, sure, no problem. And that's enabled in something like 90% of the older 1.5 version IPMI systems. And I was surprised it's that bad. I mean, I would expect half, but 90% is bad.
Well, I'm just sort of waiting for someone to do something genuinely diabolical with this. Do you know what I mean? Because it's been known about for a while. Again, it's sort of like some of those reflection attacks that have been used to do, awful, awful DDoSes. Like, how long before someone actually decides to go out there, hit up a lot of these management interfaces and then do awful things with them, I imagine there's a number of awful things you could do with them.
Yeah, and certainly what you will see is that hosting providers that have a particular vulnerable piece of kit and have the IPMI on the internet, so we'll get, every box in their entire environment compromised in one go. And then we'll see scenarios like distributed IT where entire hosting providers just disappear from the network. They get burnt down by an attacker who has a grievance, and that's the end of it. So I think we'll see that kind of thing, these bugs being used for that kind of thing.
Oh, now, some bad, bad people made an awful lot of money out of selling fake AV for Windows. It looks like, a few Android security apps have been booted from the Amazon Android store and Google Play. They were charging a couple of bucks for it. It looks like they had like 50,000 downloads. Not a bad little score.
Yeah, FireEye picked up, five separate apps that Google's now pulled out of the App Store, all made by one guy that, hacker, anti-hacker plus, or, antivirus. They essentially did absolutely nothing whatsoever. There are still some, other applications in the Play Store that, are the same sort of scam. I just wish people wouldn't fall for this kind of thing, because we've told them. I guess it's our fault. Really,
it's our fault, man. Come on, you can't blame
the actual
users.
We've told them antivirus protects them, and you're right. It's totally our fault. We should, between OpenSSL and this and TrueCrypt, we should just all go out the back and shoot ourselves. Clearly,
now U.S. authorities have, continuing in their spirit of indicting people who they'll never get to bring to trial. They've indicted a guy called Evgeny Mikhailovich Bogachev. Guess where he's from? He's a Russian guy who has apparently stolen up to $100 million through the Zeus botnet. So that's an interesting one. Now, funnily enough, the next story that we have to discuss was written by Darren Pawley for The Register. It turns out, ChronoPay, that guy, the Russian guy, is running a really dodgy payments network, made himself a lot of money. Pavel Vrublevsky, he had all sorts of connections in the Russian government and whatever. His luck eventually ran out. He went to prison. He's been sprung early to work on a state-sponsored payment system. I mean, this is just so very
only
Russia.
In Russia, right? Only yeah. In Russia. Now this is the guy who's was convicted because his payments company was paying someone to DOS the competing payments company, right? And that's what they eventually got.
Well, that's what they got him for. But he was involved in all sorts of stuff.
Fake farmer and all sorts of things by the sound of it. But yeah, popped early to work on a state-sponsored payment system, which is presumably going to compete with, his old, business competitors. Russia.
Anyway, Russia. Yeah. Good luck extraditing that other guy, US. He's probably going to wind up being the Minister for Technology by the end of the year, you know. Now, Monsanto, you know, this isn't a particularly interesting story, but Monsanto got owned. There was a data breach at their precision planting unit. The only reason I include this is because Monsanto is like a blood-sucking, parasitic, evil organization, and I fully encourage anyone to cause as much trouble for them as possible.
Ooh, no, it's funny that we haven't seen, you know, real environmental activism against something like Monsanto using hacker techniques, you know, either through, you know, via, under the anonymous banner or wherever else. And I was surprised to see this as just, you know, oh, we lost some data about customers and some data about staff. You know, there was, they lost some tax forms and things that had all the necessary information to identity thief employees at Monsanto. And you can imagine that's the sort of thing that, you know, some of the more, you know, proactive, you know, anti, Monsanto groups would probably be going to make reasonable hay out of, if you'll excuse the
zing. Not that I'm encouraging anyone to do anything illegal to Monsanto, but I am not, or am I?
Much,
maybe. Ish. I don't know. Yeah, there you go. Now, look, there's been a story developing over the last hour or so. Irongeek.com is a, you know, resource of recorded security presentations. There's something like 1,000 videos there, all hosted on YouTube. Google has actually terminated that YouTube channel. No news just yet on why. It could be anything. Could be that there was copyright music in some of these videos. It could be that one of the people who was, you know, who he'd recorded didn't want to be in the video anymore. But either way, I mean, this is a pretty big loss in terms of an online resource.
Yeah, it certainly seems like a pretty heavy-handed effect for, you know, whatever reason it ended up getting taken down. It's interesting, the account comes up as being, like, closed, gone, not, you know, this video is not available because copyright, you know, DMCA.
No, it said this channel has been terminated.
Yeah, which is like that's
like hasta la vista, baby, terminated. Yeah. Not shut down, not suspended, terminated. Yeah.
So no, and it's not quite clear what's going on, but yes, it's a lot of content to disappear in one go for, you know, reasons we don't really know about yet.
Mm. Now, just moving on to a couple of bugs before we wrap it up for the week. Apache has patched information disclosure bugs in Tomcat. Do people still use Tomcat, really?
Yeah, Tomcat's quite widely deployed, and bugs in Tomcat. There's lots of embedded systems and lots of big stuff that uses Tomcat. So none of these are world-ending bugs. One of them looks particularly... You know,
I just noticed that one of them was found by Dave Jorm. Way to go, Dave. Aussie guy.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, we saw Dave last KiwiCon, actually. He's a chum of KiwiCon and an all-around nice guy. But yeah, bugs in Tomcat are... yeah, even just InfoLeak bugs are quite useful because, you know, if you've got you know, any foothold in those systems, then usually you're well on your way to an enterprise-wide compromise.
There you go. Enterprise-wide compromise. It's actually the right description, but it sounds like a way too polite euphemism. But anyway, Microsoft is also patching an IE8 zero day on Patch Tuesday.
Yeah, this is one of the ones that ZDI ended up disclosing, you know, after a 6-month wait of it not being patched. But they are actually going to fix this one. It's a bug going back to 8.1 and
so not in the wild.
We haven't heard reports of this one in the wild, but you know, if the patch gets out there, then people will be reversing it, and then we will see it
in the wild.
In the wild.
All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news, mate. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been fun as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, cheers, Pat. I look forward to it.
Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's news headlines. Big thanks to him. And it is time for this week's feature interview now with Wired journalist Andy Greenberg. Andy worked for Forbes for around 7.5 years before making the switch to Wired.com last month. He has a particular interest in cryptocurrency and underground markets, and his coverage in the space has been really, really quite good. Definitely go to wired.com/threat level to check it out. Andy also wrote a book a few years ago about WikiLeaks called This Machine Kills Secrets, which documented the rise and the fall of WikiLeaks. Like WikiLeaks, one thing I've wondered is whether Silk Road was a flash in the pan. It was thoroughly infiltrated by the FBI and shut down. Does this invalidate the idea that technology can enable an open marketplace that cannot be thoroughly compromised? Well, Andy isn't so sure. Here he is.
There are definitely already advancements that are happening on the Silk Road model. I agree that it's very difficult to run one of these sites and not make the kind of human errors that get you caught. You know, like OPSEC is really, really difficult. But I think that the results of getting caught for these sites is being reduced. In the same way that Napster evolved into BitTorrent and became more decentralized, there's no the single point of failure leads to a less epic failure than it ever did in the past. There's now there's things like multi-signature transactions in Bitcoin that make it so that if the administrator of the site is arrested or just runs away, tries to run away with the money, 2 out of 3 of the participants in the transaction have to sign the Bitcoin transaction, so that basically no one person can just take the money.
So it's like a built-in crypto escrow almost.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a true crypto escrow, as you say, rather than a kind of just trust-based escrow. And that's just the beginning. I mean, we've started to see now these true decentralized marketplace prototypes like Dark Markets, which was created by Amir Taki and some other guys. And
these are the really distributed ones that kind of work like Bitcoin. Are those the ones you mean?
Yeah, the idea is that there is no actual administrator. Anyone can choose to host basically a seller page on their own computer. You know, these are really flimsy prototypes for now, but I think they point towards a future where the police, if they want to take down one of these markets, will have to go after every single person one at a time, just in the same way that BitTorrent is basically totally become this multi-headed hydra thing that you can't shut down.
Now, it's interesting when you mentioned, you used the words a good start or an interesting start with in relation to Bitcoin. You know, is Bitcoin a starting point? Do you think Bitcoin is going to fizzle? Because I can't see, I can see the cryptocurrency is going to be around. They're here to stay. But what do you think of Bitcoin itself? Because it seems like things like Zerocoin, are coming along. Dogecoin, if you will, also popping up. Do you think it's only a matter of time before Bitcoin is sort of replaced with a superior standard?
I don't think Bitcoin will actually be replaced. I think that the network effects of Bitcoin are too powerful. It's like the internet in the sense that, we could make a better internet too, but nobody's going to use it. And these other coins are really peripheral for now. I think that they're super interesting, but they're very shallow markets that can be manipulated pretty easily. Darkcoin is the one that I've been following lately, which is kind of like, it's kind of an early version of Zerocoin. Zerocoin is supposed to offer perfect anonymity in a way for its users. Darkcoin offers kind of like, something like Tor-like anonymity, or maybe someday it will be that robust. It's not impossible to identify Darkcoin users by any means, but it offers like one more layer of anonymity than Bitcoin does. But even so, people are really just using Darkcoin. Well, I don't want to, this is maybe too strong a statement, I'm not sure, but it seems like people are just using Darkcoin to anonymize their Bitcoins. They trade their Bitcoins for Darkcoins and back, and in the process, their Bitcoins become very hard to follow.
So it's really just a method of, making that transfer difficult to trace, but the value is still stored in Bitcoins.
I think so, but probably Darkcoin people would argue otherwise, but I just don't see a lot of people accepting Darkcoin for goods and services. I've seen like 2 people doing that, and one of them is like selling marijuana seeds. It's kind of a fringe thing. It's not going to be like Bitcoin in the sense that it's harder to imagine Tiger Direct starting to accept Darkcoin, and that's the kind of thing that's made Bitcoin grow in value.
Now, you had a really interesting piece up, I think it was last week, about this idea, or it could have even been this week, about this idea that a couple of academics were floating, which is that these underground marketplaces actually result in a safer, less violent marketplace for illicit goods and illicit services. I could see you quite, questioning their theory in, if you read between the lines in your story, you were certainly questioning their theory. But what do you make of it? What is your, unfiltered opinion? Do you think that these marketplaces for illegal things on the internet do have potential to solve a lot of the problems associated with organized crime?
I think so. What I was questioning about the study was really more of how they drew their conclusions. Their actual data wasn't really about violence. Their quantitative data was about the size of transactions on the Silk Road, and they showed that it was more of a business-to-business marketplace. And then they kind of had some weird logic to argue based on that there was less, there was more kind of nonviolent tendencies created by the sites than people believed. But so I kind of questioned how they arrived at this conclusion, but I absolutely agree with the conclusion that that online drug marketplaces do reduce violence. It seems like a pretty clear, intuitive conclusion to draw that when people can't identify or find each other, it's very difficult for them to, you know, do drive-by shootings or behead each other and, you know, and like
all the lovely things that the Mexican cartels do.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the interesting thing is that we do see kind of like virtual violence in the drug marketplaces, that these sites are always under DDoS attacks, but you know, a DDoS attack doesn't kill anybody. It's a pretty piddling version of violence compared to the truly horrific things that happen in the real world drug marketplaces. So I totally agree with the researchers. If anything, I was just kind of questioning how, you know, the logical chain that they used to come to that conclusion.
Now, you did mention WikiLeaks earlier, and you know, I'm curious, as the author of the book, was it called This Machine Steals Secrets? Is that right?
Yeah, This Machine Kills Secrets.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, it's been several years now since the whole WikiLeaks thing blew up. I mean, do you have any reflections on that time, the rise and the fall of WikiLeaks, on Assange? I mean, how much do you think Assange... I mean, I reckon Assange certainly mishandled a lot of WikiLeaks-related stuff, and that contributed to the demise of WikiLeaks as a sort of functioning organization. I mean... I just wonder what your thoughts are, though, being someone who's obviously spent a lot of time researching WikiLeaks as a thing.
Yeah, well, you know, the book was really kind of about the rise and fall of WikiLeaks, but then also how it planted the seeds for a new movement of these information freedom-focused leak sites. And that didn't happen in time, really, for my book. Like, I found a couple of examples of, like, Balkan leaks. This Bulgarian group had basically replicated WikiLeaks and was really successfully leaking stuff that eventually helped to cause the downfall of the Bulgarian president, you know, and people weren't aware of this. But I think that in some ways, my book was definitely too early. Like, there, the 50 some sites that ended in the word leaks, very few of them actually published any leaks in the end. But I think only now is this stuff coming to fruition in a way. You see SecureDrop, this Tor-based leak anonymous submission system that's being adopted now by, I don't know, dozens of media organizations, including some really high-profile ones. And, you know, I look at a group like First Look Media in The Intercepts, run by Glenn Greenwald and those guys, and it seems to me like that might be the new model for WikiLeaks, like this very OPSEC-oriented, aggressive media organization that has already proven that it's willing to publish highly controversial leaks and now has the tools to enable future leakers as well.
This is actually one thing that I wonder about, Andy, is you know, WikiLeaks' whole philosophy of we'll just leak everything and to hell with the consequences. It seems like, you know, when WikiLeaks came along, we had that conversation as a society. The intelligentsia really thrashed out that conversation and said, is this a good approach? And we seem to have come full circle and back to the original proposition of the media, which is it will publish information that is in the public interest. So to what degree do you think the WikiLeaks experience invalidated its original philosophy?
It's interesting to look at Snowden, because he could have given this stuff to WikiLeaks. And instead, he chose Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. I think because he saw that they would be very adversarial with the government. They would publish everything they thought had any public interest value, but they would still also filter it. You know, and I think that if Snowden is any kind of archetype for whistleblowers, that's probably what a lot of whistleblowers want. They, you know, they appreciate that someone else is taking responsibility and not just publishing at all. And actually, you know, WikiLeaks is certainly even more aggressive than Glenn Greenwald, and you see this in the conflict between them. But WikiLeaks also totally took this responsibility on themselves and their later leaks that they would redact the documents. It was just very difficult for them to do it because they were actually a very under-resourced group that was kind of like a pufferfish with this big presence, but not a lot of actual manpower behind it.
Yeah, well, their initial redactions weren't too crash hot either. I'm sure there's plenty of ruined lives in places like Afghanistan due to their, you know, crappy redaction of the initial dump of the war logs.
It's really hard to say. I mean, that's never really been shown, and I certainly looked for it, especially in the Cablegate documents, which WikiLeaks, you know, of course, tried to redact and worked, you know, put a lot of resources into filtering, and then accidentally they were all leaked. Even then, there were some cases of people, you know, journalists had to flee Ethiopia, for instance. And I think that some people in Iraq were warned that they should leave the country, but it's never been shown that any actual violence resulted from.
Well, you know, I just think being, you know, forced to leave your own country is maybe not an ideal outcome, when a simple redaction probably would have helped, right?
That was an awful fiasco. Mm. But yeah, like you said, ruined lives. But the blood on the hands thing, you know, that's what the army has said. And that I don't think has ever been proven.
Mm. Or maybe not ever admitted. I mean, it's difficult to know. Which PR scenario for the US military is worse, admitting that they failed to protect people who spoke to them? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a little bit difficult for them operating in a country like Afghanistan to say, to acknowledge that people who spoke to them were subsequently murdered. So you've really got to wonder how they're actually playing that hand from a PR perspective.
Right. I have never been on the side of the maybe like early Julian Assange, present day John Young of Cryptome belief that just publish it all. Like I think that you can see that Glenn Greenwald is maybe the most adversarial journalist alive today, or I don't know, journalist who's worked with mainstream media organizations.
Is he a journalist or is he an activist? I mean, I have a really hard time figuring out which he is, to be honest.
I would say that he's both. But my point is that even he believes, you know, we saw this recent leak where he redacted the name of a country, an entire country that was being wiretapped. So there's like you said, this discussion has come back to the point that some redaction is in the public interest.
Mm. All righty. Well, Andy Greenberg, thank you very much for taking some time out of your evening over there in New York to have a chat to us on Risky Business.
Well, it's been fun. Thanks.
Wired's Andy Greenberg there with a chat about underground marketplaces, leaks, media, and more. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay of Senatas. Senatas makes layer 2 encryption technology. Go to senatas.com to check out their products. Now, being the CTO of a company that makes its money out of encryption technology, Julian has followed the recent TrueCrypt fiasco with a high level of interest. Now, some people are saying the project shutdown was a NSA plot. Others are saying there's been some lava bitting going on, that they've been served with some sort of national security letter, and that's why they've chosen to shut it down instead. But perhaps the most plausible explanation I've heard came from a comment on a Brian Krebs story about the initial TrueCrypt shutdown. The commenter, who calls himself Bill Cole, wrote, and I quote, "The ISEC initial audit report was very critical of the TrueCrypt code quality and implied that it looks like the work of a single coder. There was no update for 2 years. The build process requires a 20-year-old Microsoft compiler manually extracted from an XE installer. Imagine yourself as the lead solo developer working on TrueCrypt. No one pays you for this, governments hate you, much of the crypto community is throwing rocks at you, while your user community spends half of its time joining in with clueless paranoia and the other half whining about feature gaps. You have to eat, so you have a real paying job. You're not so young anymore because you've been doing TrueCrypt crap for a decade, and maybe the real job now includes responsibilities that crowd out side work. Or maybe you've got a family you love more than the whiny paranoids you encounter via TrueCrypt. And now ISEC is telling you your code is sloppy and unreadable and that you should take on a buttload of mind-numbing work to pretty it up so they'll have an easier time figuring out where some scotch-fueled coding session in 2005 resulted in a gaping exploitable hole that everyone will end up calling an NSA backdoor. Maybe you just toss it in. Why not? Anyone with a maintained OS has an integrated alternative, and as imperfect as they may be, they are better than TrueCrypt for most users. Maintaining TrueCrypt isn't really doing much good for many people, and the audit just pushed a giant steaming pile of the least interesting sort of maintenance into top priority. Seems like a fine time to drop it and be your kid's soccer coach." And that's the end of the comment. I got to say, this also strikes me as the most plausible explanation. So I thought I'd get Julian's thoughts on this. Is this the most plausible scenario? And what are his thoughts on the best models for validating crypto? Is it going to be open source? Is it proprietary? Is it just using some of these checklists like FIPS? He joined me by phone from Disney World in Orlando, Florida, where he's attending a conference. And here's what he had to say.
Look, I was just stunned when I first heard it. It's just really weird. I couldn't understand it. Read all the conspiracy theories. I mean, there's no evidence to suggest any of them. But when I thought about it overnight last night, I reckon the developers have just got tired. You know,
yeah.
You sent me that Krebs link, the comment that some guy had posted, about the guy just getting pissed off. And you know, they've been doing this for 10 years. They've had a pile of crap thrown on them from various sources and a lot of bug fixing to do. And I imagine they got tired and got sick of it.
Yeah, but, well, and they're about to have an absolute crap ton of bug fixes forced on them as well.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I guess it's interesting because it kind of brings back into sort of conversation the whole topic of how do you actually get assurance in crypto software? You know, and is open source always going to be better than closed source software? So I think there's a lot of interesting things that the conversation raises.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is something that has been discussed through the ages. I think Peter Goodman did a great presentation at one of the earlier KiwiCons about, you know, the bystander effect, you know, where if someone's screaming out help, rape, rape, no one really does anything because they all assume the other person's calling the cops. He sort of equated that to open source code, which is, sure, it's all there and it's available. So everyone assumes that the transparency brings with it expert analysis and auditing, but it's not really how it works out in real life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things I learned about sending an email, let's say you're sending an email to a group of people, and instead of saying, hey, Steve, can you get me an answer on this? I need it as soon as possible. You just say, hey, guys, can someone get me an answer on this? You know, one of the first things you learn is you never get an answer from a group email unless you actually call someone out and say, hey, dude, I need this. So it's the same sort of effect. Just because it's transparent and it is available to be scrutinized doesn't mean that anybody's actually done it. And if they have, who was the person who did it? What sort of skills have they got, et cetera? So, you know, that conventional wisdom that open source, you know, many eyes, shallow bugs, et cetera, by definition is going to be better. I think actually when you dig beneath the surface, there's actually no objective evidence, you know, so probably good open source is as good as good proprietary code, and bad open source is as bad proprietary. It's just a matter of how to get your assurance up.
Yeah, look, I mean, I can definitely see the virtue with open source crypto in particular, because an open standard is very important when you're relying on it and you need that level of assurance that it can be audited. It's not just like using regular regular software. And, you know, with that, we've got a long history of proprietary closed source crypto being genuinely hideous, right?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say on the crypto space, on the commercial area, is that unlike most commercial software, there are a number of standards and audit processes that are put in place to try and at least demonstrate that implementations are secure. So I'm thinking about FIPS, common criteria, schemes of that sort. Now, they're not perfect, but at least there are codified processes that sort of tend to keep things on the straight and narrow. And as a result of that, there are many solutions that are sort of trusted by government and consumers because they've come out of that process. And the purpose of those is, I mean, they do provide at least a metric that's completely independent of the vendor's word. Even if the source code isn't transparently available for someone to analyze, at least there is a third party doing a detailed analysis, hopefully by an expert in the field. And more than that, the best of those schemes, they don't just do black box evaluations. They sort of enforce and require full product and coding lifecycle standards. So I think there's a lot of benefit in those.
What do you think? I've got to ask though, because you know there is this problem with open source code that people just, they've got better things to do in their spare time, honestly, than trawling through someone else's awful, awful code looking for mistakes that they may have made, right? But what do you think about this idea of bounties as a motivator? Because it seems to work extremely well.
Yeah, exactly. So you need to put the incentives in place. I mean, the TrueCrypt audit was a great start. So, you know, there we had a scheme where someone's going to take a look at a highly used piece of code that was had some questions around it. You're going to get a bunch of experts. We're going to go in and get paid for doing that work. And what did they raise? Was it 16,000 they started asking and they got up to 70,000?
Yeah.
So this stuff's expensive, yeah? It takes a lot of time. You know, it takes weeks and months. I mean, I can't remember exactly how long they took, several months to audit the first part of TrueCrypt. They hadn't finished. So that's why these standards cost a lot of money. So I think, you know, putting the incentives in place for this to happen and you know, it's got to be some sort of reward at the end of it is a good idea.
I just wonder, I mean, that's, you know, hiring an audit, you know, group of auditors to get people to actually methodically do it. I mean, I wonder why a portion of that money wasn't just thrown into a bounty pool because, you know, if there's a possibility of reward at the end of it, even if it's just, you know, $1,000, $2,000, I mean, people are going to throw more than $1,000 or $2,000 worth of effort at it just for the intellectual challenge. They've got, all of a sudden, there's a carrot on a stick there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one challenge is making sure the audit's done properly and actually, you know, auditing the audit. How do you know that, you know, the person who did the job did a good enough job and they're experts? I mean, these bugs are so subtle. I mean, there's a lot of automatic code testing tools that, of course, that we all use. There's tools like Coverity and Codenomicon. And Coverity is one of the well-known ones. They've just released something called Coverity Scan, which is a free tool for scanning open source software. But in its initial form, it still didn't find the actual Heartbleed bug, for example, because it was a very complicated, you know, it was a tainted data source.
How are you going to know that that's a bug through static analysis?
Yeah, I can't remember. It was a double pointer redirect and some tainted source data. They were swapping bytes around. Now, they claim that they've actually analyzed it and their latest version would pick up that. But then you get a lot of sort of false positives. So there's always this trade-off, isn't there, in these tools, you know, getting the false positives eventually find the real work. So I think it's great. It's a great progress that these tools are now being made available, and that hopefully there'll be more scrutiny. But
now we've got nothing to replace TrueCrypt. I mean, I can't think of software as sort of usable as that, that's going to allow me to create an image and then throw a hidden container into it with deniable crypto and stuff. I mean, how long's it? Maybe we need to start from scratch with this particular tool set.
Well, they reckon it's been forked in Switzerland, don't they? That was the news yesterday.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's time to just.
And hey, you don't like BitLocker?
Well, I mean, I can't do a deniable volume with BitLocker, can I? Indeed.
Okay, you got me. Interesting to see what happens with the fork, though, because the licensing issue is a bit complex as well, isn't it? Because it wasn't it was a funny licensing scheme, so whether they can actually do that, I don't know.
Yeah, and it was funny. Oh, not funny, haha. Yeah, not so schmicko. So, look, if you were the ruler of the world for a day and you were going to mandate some, or you were going to create some project to replace TrueCrypt, what sort of audit would you give it? I mean, I imagine you'd throw the works at it. You'd go for a little bit of static analysis, you'd go for an audit, and you'd go for a bounty, and you'd keep it open source. Is that sort of how you'd approach it?
Yeah, I mean, TrueCrypt was pretty good, yeah? So you'd probably go back to 7.1, right? The last version is, a couple of years old now. And you'd probably start with that and assume you get your licensing right. You go, well, that's a pretty good base. And then you do what you've said. You put it through a full audit. You use the tools that are available. You give some incentives for the community, fire a bounty to step up and do the analysis. And if you go through that, and that'll take a long time, I mean, that'll take months. At the end of that, hopefully you've got a firmware version that's repeatedly able to be built with known signatures, and you've got a pretty good baseline then to move forward.
And would you expect, though, do you think that there will be other software that will come into the fray, or do you think these forks will actually work out? If you had to guess, gut feel, because I just have a feeling the fork's going to die.
Do you?
Yeah. I do.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert. There are a couple of other similar tools that have been around a while, but I've understood that TrueCrypt was sort of leader of the pack. So I think that would be our best bet for moving forwards. But I don't know. I mean, 10 years of work went into this. It was a very sophisticated product, great user interface. You know, recreating that overnight is not going to happen. So I'd have thought building on what was the last known good build, to the extent we know it's good, is probably the most sensible strategy.
Why do you think whoever it is who created TrueCrypt, whether it was a person or a group, why do you think they kept it anonymous? Do you think it could have been complicated for them because they might work, in sort of the military digital complex, or they perhaps work for the NSA or something like that, and they just didn't want to associate their name with a product like that? I mean, why is it that they're anonymous?
I don't know. Any of the above, I guess. Could be a nerdy developer who's just uber shy and doesn't want the limelight. I mean, with the, once you get a lot of attention with these things, you get a lot of good and bad press. Like the flappy bird guy took the product down after 2 months because of all the attention he was getting. And I can understand. It's much easier. It gives you the option, I guess, to walk away without damaging your reputation or your name in a way that they may have just done now because they got tired of it. Whereas if if you're not sort of seeking the limelight and you don't want all the attention, the good and bad that comes with it, then that's a real pain in the ass.
Well, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it, that they might have stayed anonymous precisely so they could pull this move?
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
Or maybe they're just a really patient prankster, 10 years, get millions of people using it, and then and now they're having lulls.
Well, it's funny that they explicitly said now that XP is end of life, we're ending TrueCrypt. It's almost like they think they're doing a public service because there's no good solution for XP. Now that that's officially end of life, it's like a good excuse for them to stop development and, hey, you guys just go and use BitLocker or whatever, FileVault or whatever.
Yeah. Our work here is done.
Yeah, exactly. We've had enough. We're going to Disneyland.
Yeah, that's right. All right, Julian Fay, thank you very much for joining us prior to your breakfast over there in Orlando. Appreciate your time, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Thanks, Pat. Speak soon.
Julian Fay there with a chat about TrueCrypt and encryption validation. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is by the Perch Creek Family Jug Band. They started up here around the Northern Rivers, but these days they're based in Melbourne. They will be touring through the Netherlands this month and then to the UK in July and a few dates in Canada in August. This song is called The Great Unknown, and it was recorded live at the Northcote Social Club in Melbourne. So, you know, keep that in mind when you listen to this, that it is live. They do a sensational show. There's a link to the YouTube clip of them performing this, and also a link to their website in this week's show notes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go and collapse and recover now. Bye-bye.
Everybody stand tall.